What's the actual duration of the trip? How many miles?
Oh, I can't. I think I've got it written down here somewhere.
What is it, about 3,000 miles? Something like that?
It is 2,832. You were very close.
Yeah, I walked it once. That's why I know. All right. Nice. Safe trip.
Thank you.
So your wife is off service now. She's not in service.
No, she's changing duty stations.
So that means she'll be located in South Carolina with you?
Oh, yes. She'll be in Fort Jackson. That's why we're moving, actually, because she's been transferred.
Okay, very good. So that means no more time apart.
That's right. At least for 3 years, what we should be here together. Yeah.
Very good. Good news. All right, so who else do we have? Anybody else online? We still early at that. Okay, everybody got 8:15. Let's wait a couple of minutes. I don't think anybody else is online yet. Pick up where we did last week.
Hi, good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Rebecca.
Hi. Hi. We had a sun in New York today.
Yeah, it's supposed to be sunny for the next full week.
Oh, it's supposed to be, right. Hope so.
It'll be nice. Nice week.
Yeah.
Put on that mute button, Rivka. I'm going to start as soon as anybody else joins in.
Rabbi, I have a question about a couple weeks ago. Well, we were talking about Sforno's explanation. What verse were we? And I have my book in front of me. We've been sort of in and out, and it's been a little crazy as it is. We were talking about the righteous sometimes suffer, and Sforno says that the reason is because there must have been something they did to cause it, a sin or something like that. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, he says on verse 8:14 that he says that the futility, which is bothersome to people, or the vanity, something which is troubling, is when the righteous experience what should happen to the wicked, meaning they have negative occurrences in life, and conversely, the wicked seem to enjoy very good lives. And he says that this, I said, is also futility. So Sforno says on that there are certain righteous people that what reaches them is like the fate of the wicked, meaning negative lives. Meaning what? That they acquire a negative name amongst the people. Like it happens to a person who's very pious, but he's foolish. He's a fool. He's like a very minimal intellect. So he doesn't make wise decisions all the time. So even though he has good intent, but his intent is only based on the minimal knowledge that he has. So he makes poor decisions and people poke fun at him and he loses his reputation. And the wicked that are very cunning, meaning they have a very big dose of acumen, and but their motives are all for self-gain. So they'll do things very cunningly to acquire a good name in the world, even though they're internally wicked. And it's those two occurrences is what Sforno says. But he wants to avoid saying that a righteous person who's intelligent is going to have a real negative life. And he's right, because the way the world operates, we said, is that if you do certain actions, they result And if you make right decisions, and how certainly the correct decisions in business, then you understand the business well. So, of course, it'll yield more success than if a person makes foolish decisions. So, on the whole, there's definitely rules by which the world operates. So, if a person is intelligent and makes good decisions, right? But sometimes you'll still have a person who's very intelligent, but their motivation is still for self-gain.
Right. Thank you. That does answer my question. I had misunderstood the point, but that clarification helps. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, and that's basically what the Ibn Ezra says the theme is. He says for the next 16 verses about this whole thing about some righteous people experiencing negativity and some evil people experiencing, you know, good lives. So that's what we'll be continuing on this theme. He'll bring us. He lays down what the main question is at the outset. Then we said that was 14. In 15, we said that King Solomon says that I praise in enjoyment. Because there's no real good for man under the sun other than he should eat and drink and be happy, and this will accompany him with his labor, which God the judge has given him under the sun. And we said in that is, why is he now bringing that in? He was just talking about one topic, about justice of the evil and the righteous. And now he talks about enjoyment of, like, you know, eating and drinking. So what we said was is that he's trying to contrast what's within man's ability to really know is good for him and what is outside his range. So I was suggesting that's what he juxtaposes 15 to 14. 14 is a very difficult question. We did mention, however, that, you know, King David says clearly that, you know, there may be like seven things that will occur to the downfalls or mishaps may occur, and they may commence. He says the Shevi Yipol Tzadik, that then seven negative things might happen, meaning many negative things might commence to a tzaddik, the righteous person, but he's saved from all of them. All of them. And he says, not one of his bones is broken. So King David's words are have to be understood in this as well. I mean, again, King David was King Solomon's father. And he was saying that in terms of the absolute, you know, a person's absolutely righteous. So God's going to save him. It would not be just. And we also quoted Maimonides in the Guide for Perplexed, where he says that God uses justice, but the method of which is beyond man's ability. All right, let me see if I have that. Where did he say that? Says, it is due to the will, and it is due to the will of God, and is in accordance with the justice of his judgments, meaning why certain mishaps happen to people, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. It's page 287 in the Divine Providence in the Guide for Perplexed. So here he says that clearly, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. And that's what King Solomon says here as well. He says that in the next verse. He says, when I gave my heart over, in 16, when I gave my heart over to know wisdom and to see the matter which is performed on the land, even day and night, sleep I did not give to my eyes. I did not see sleep. Okay, so on the surface that means that he was pondering this matter of justice for both the righteous and for the evil, and why sometimes we don't see why. The basic question is, why is it that the righteous aren't experiencing great lives 100% of the time? Why is it that the wicked are not experiencing negative lives 100% of the time? All right, so that is what, like, for example, when Maimonides I just quoted, he's talking about how when justice reaches certain people. What page did I say that it was again? Yeah, 287. He says, for example, it may be, he gives us his principle of divine providence. For I do not believe that it is through the interference of divine providence that a certain leaf drops from a tree, nor do I hold that when a certain spider catches a certain fly, that it is the direct result of a special decree and will of God at that moment. It is not by a particular divine decree that the spittle of a certain person moved, fell on a certain insect in a certain place and killed it, nor is it by the direct will of God that a certain fish catches and swallows a certain worm on the surface of the water. In all these cases, the action is, according to my opinion, entirely due to chance as taught by Aristotle. Divine providence is connected with divine intellectual influence. And these creatures, again, I'm just saying parenthetically, he'll explain that. Let me just read his words. He says, the divine providence is connected, meaning God's providence over beings is going to relate to what type of being. It's connected with the divine intellectual influence. And the same beings, meaning man only, which are benefited by the latter, meaning man alone has intellectual influence, no other creature has intellect. So he says, the same beings which are benefited by the latter, that have intelligence, so as to become intellectual and to comprehend things comprehensible to rational beings, those beings are also under the control of divine providence, which examines all their deeds in order to reward or punish them. It may be by mere chance that the ship goes down with all her contents, as in the above mentioned instance, or the roof of a house falls upon those within, but is not due to chance, according to our view, that in the one instance the men went into the ship or remained in the house in the other instance. It is due to the will of God, and is in accordance with the justice of his judgment, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. Okay. Just put on your mute buttons, please. I'm getting feedback.
Sorry, my fault.
No problem. Okay, so you see there, he says that it may be by chance, although it doesn't have to be by chance, that a ship sinks or the roof of a house collapses. God can control that too. But that may be by chance, because those things aren't completely underneath justice. But human beings, which are and again, I'm reading from page 287 in the Guide for Perplexed, the Friedlander edition. But it is not due to chance, according to our view, that in the one instance the men went into the ship or remained in the house in the other instance. It is due to the will of God and is in accordance with the justice of his judgments, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. Now, he's making a very strong statement that, and like King David said, the person's completely righteous, so God will save the righteous person from all the mishaps. Right, that is, I believe, let me read that to you. That's in Psalms. Yeah. 34. Psalm 34. So King David says, I searched out God and he answered me. And from all my terror he delivered me. From all. This poor individual would call out to God, and from all of his troubles he saved him. God encamps his angels around those who fear him, and they are saved. The holy ones fear God, and there is no lacking to those who revere him. No lacking. Young lions may roar from hunger, but those who search our God will not lack any good. He continues. He talks about the perfect, how a person guards his tongue from evil and from his lips from speaking any type of deceit. He's honest. This is the type of person that he's depicting. So you see, it's not just any person who you assess as good. Look at the level of the person. He does not speak any evil, and his lips have no deceit. He turns away from evil, and he only does good. He searches out peace, and he chases after it. So God's eyes are to those righteous ones, and his ears are to the ones who call out to him. They call out to God, and he hears, and from all of their distress, he saves them. Again, all. The word all is mentioned numerous times in this Psalm 34. God is close to those who are brokenhearted, and those who are broken-spirited, he saves. There's a saying somewhere else, I forget, that God, what is the sacrifice of God? The broken spirit. That's a sacrifice, meaning metaphorically, what is a person to offer? Not as animals and just go through the actions. No, the real core aspect of sacrifice is the fact that the person subordinates himself to God. He breaks down his, we talked about the brazenness. The person removes himself from that type of a lifestyle. And here's the one I just quoted. Many evils will happen to the righteous person, but from all of them, God will save him. So what does it mean many evils will happen? Why do the evils even have to start then? So that means the evils, if God saves him, so the evils really are not going to affect him. But since the world does work in a certain way, and God does not halt free will, there are going to be enemies to the righteous person, primarily because of jealousy. People see, that's what there's a saying, that the memory of the righteous is for good. So I'm not sure who said it, or maybe it was Rabbi Chaik. Why is it that the memory of the righteous is too good? Why isn't it while he's alive? What do you mean the memory, when he's dead? Because when he's alive, the fact that he does good, that opposes a person who wants that freedom to satisfy his instincts, and it bothers him when he sees that a person really can follow properly. So during the life of the tzaddik, people resent him because it shows them, by contrast, that they're really not like him. So that's how a person reacts, typically. It's an infantile reaction. You see somebody else is really embodying the good, and it shows you openly your shortcomings, so you don't perfect yourself, you put him down. You degrade him in order to salvage some vestige of self-esteem, but in a very corrupt way. The person doesn't want to face his shortcomings. And when he sees the righteous, he puts them down. So that's what it means, that there will be negative things. Doesn't mean... In another place, he says seven things occur to the righteous, meaning many things. But here he says many. Many evils will befall the righteous person, but God saves him from all of them. Because if he's truly righteous, so God's not going to strip all the people of free will, but he will remove them. And God has that ability to completely insulate a perfectly righteous person from any mishap. Is anything outside of God's abilities? No. But of course, that's the whole question that King Solomon is talking about. We want to see 100% goodness happening to the people that we estimate as being righteous. So the first flaw with that statement is, of course, we don't know who is completely righteous. And that's what, who was that? Was that the Ibn Ezra? Somebody else said that for some evil that it did, that's why there's something happening to, that was in 8:14 again. Who was that? Yeah, that was one of the commentators, Talumas Kochmo. He talked about it. He says there are certain things that you have certain righteous people and negative things happen to them.
Rabbi?
Yeah, one second.
Okay.
Yeah, he talked about how the tribes, the ten brothers, afflicted Joseph. Right, but there was still justice in that case. God would not have let it happen. He didn't cause the brothers to do it. Of course, they had free will. That's why it was a sin. But he wouldn't have let it happen if it wasn't something that was to correct something in Joseph himself.
How do we know that?
Well, that's what David's saying, that there may be seven things which occur, or many things that we're reading right now in this Psalm 34. Many things, and again, keep in mind, Psalms and all of writings and the Torah and the prophets is all divinely inspired. So that means it's God's wisdom that the prophets are communicating to us. So if King David says, many evils happen to the tzaddik, but he is saved from all of them. So then if he's not saved, then he can't be a complete tzaddik. There has to be some negativity. There had to be something which demanded it.
Isn't it established that there's never been a 100% righteous man on the planet, that everybody sins, and therefore the statement in the Psalms always has an out?
Well, it's not an out. It's telling you that that is the absolute. And there were four people that it says in, I think, Talmud the Sabbath that didn't sin. It enumerates those four people there. But in terms of the principle that if a person is completely righteous, so then there won't be any justice in God delivering anything negative. And he's going to save him.
Yeah, but I guess I'm troubled because if the statement is saying, and I don't have Aldrin on me, but if the statement is saying, you know, if you're righteous, no bad thing will befall you, all we can say is that in the entire history of mankind, only four people made that mark, then it doesn't really seem like that's a practically operative rule. I mean, the first case that immediately comes to me is, well, what about the Holocaust? And if the argument then is made, well, out of those 6 million people, there apparently wasn't one who was totally righteous. I mean, I can hear that, but it seems like there ought to be something else there.
That would be a mar on God's complete knowledge and complete justice. I mean, we see throughout, we talked about it last week, how all the instances in the Torah, how there were, you know, people who were righteous, like Noah and his family, they were saved, and the wicked people were not. And Lot was saved, and his wife, who identified and turns back, and she looked at the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah as they were being destroyed, so she was turned into a pillar of salt. She had some element there which did not allow her to continue her life. She identified. That's where she turned around and looked. The Rebbe Chaim says she was identifying with them. And if you identify with such wicked people, so that means that she had the ability to be saved, but she forfeited that when she turned back, and she couldn't detach herself from them. In terms of the theory, again, keep in mind two things here. There's the principle. So that is that God knows all, and that he administers justice, and that nothing is beyond his ability to administer justice. And then there's our knowledge about how do we assess who is deserving and who is not. And that's really what King Solomon is saying over here, that he sees something and it's a very big problem. But he also says that he stayed up day and night, he didn't give sleep to his eyes in verse 8, 16. And in 17, I've seen all the works of God, the judge. You see, to use the word, the reference of God is judge, not creator, not bore, but he calls him Elohim, the judge. So I've seen all the works, all the actions of God. Man is not able to find them, the entirety, the actions, or the performance of what's going on underneath the sun. On account that man will strive to seek it out, meaning he'll try to find all the cases, but he won't. And also, if a person will say, a wise man will say he'll know it, he won't be able to know it. So it's a difficult thing because it's, maybe the number of cases is one aspect of it, and the conflicting results that he has, but he's human. And to have In order to actually make a rule, you have to know all the cases and know all the considerations. That's outside of man's ability. So yes, the Holocaust question, you know, renews itself. It constantly comes back up. And that's the question here that he's dealing with. And that's why he spends so many verses. But he says it's outside. He what was he spending his day and nights, you know, considering? He says that day and night, sleep I did not give my eyes. My eyes did not see sleep. Either all the facts, he wasn't able to cull all the facts, or all the considerations were just too much beyond. And he couldn't really give an answer because there were too many cases, too many considerations. So that's in terms of his own actions, his consideration, and his wanting, his desire to want to understand it, present it to, you know, the Jewish nation and the world. But in terms of what David is saying, King David, he continues in Psalm 34, and he says, God watches all of the bones of the righteous. Not one of them is broken.
But do we see that in the real world? That's the question I'm asking.
Well, I mean, you can't, like King Solomon is saying, he's trying to examine that in the real world, but he doesn't have all the facts. So we have to understand that there's the principles that are laid down prophetically, and that's where the, like Maimonides says, there's three things alone that a person should accept in life. One is what he experiences. So he knows there's an experience that he had. He knows that's true. There's no doubting your senses. Number two, what your mind tells you is correct. Your mind tells you that 2 + 2 = 4. You know that it's true. And three, it's what the rabbis transmitted, based on Torah. So you know that revelation took place. You know that God gave a system. And you know that everything that the prophets told us was from God. So that has to be absolutely true. Now, how do you apply it? What happens to you when you see questions in life? That's what you have to say. Like King Solomon says here, I don't have all the answers. There are principles, but how it's being applied, I can't explain this case. That doesn't mean the principle's not true. That means I'm lacking information. Or my mind is too feeble. I haven't got all the facts, or I haven't seen certain other principles that maybe would contribute to an explanation here. But if we feel that we've got all the information and we should have the answer, and now something in reality goes against what we assess, so that we can't say. That's really where the problem comes from. If the person feels that he's got all the answers, and now reality and experiences that happen to people, good and bad in life, it doesn't match up to what I expect. So now that if that presents a question, good. But if it presents an opposition to the Torah system, that's a problem. Because now you're saying that your mind is the be-all and end-all. And you can't really say that. Because we don't have all the information.
What I can say is, if a statement is made, and you know we're taking it on the basis of, okay, we read Psalm 34, and then I go out in the world, and it, from as best I can observe, that statement doesn't hold, then I have to either question, I'm misunderstanding the statement, or my original premise is wrong.
No, there's the other possibility, that you don't have all the facts. You're assessing this person as really he's perfect. Why is he having a negative life or a negative occurrence? Maybe it's because you don't know what else he's done in his life. Maybe you don't know the considerations that are beyond of what you've witnessed. So you don't know all the facts. Isn't that a possibility?
It is, but it also seems like it's...
And that's not all the time either. Keep in mind, it's not all the time.
It's like an easy way to get out of the corner. I look and I say, well, my conclusion, you know, from math was that 2 + 2 = 4, but here I see equals 5, so I conclude, well, I guess I don't have all the facts. But somehow that seems like I'm just...
Well, let me ask you a question. Let's say you do see it practically today. A person that you assess as being fantastic is having, you know, a terrible life, rough time in business, whatever it is. Isn't it true that you have not watched that person from day one and what he's done and what his feelings are and his attachments and his actions since the day he was 13 and made responsible for himself, and now he's 60. I mean, isn't there, wouldn't you say that 90% of his experience on Earth you're completely unaware of?
On an individual basis, I would say that, yes, that's true. I can't know what's going on in any single person's life. When I look at 6 million, it starts to make it a little more difficult
right.
for me to accept.
Right.
That's kind of where I'm headed. And if we say, well, this really only works if a person, if you can really all count on it, absolutely 100% righteous the whole life and never sinned, then I scratch my head and say, well, why is David telling us this? Because it's such a limiting case that, you know, only half a dozen people in the history of mankind will ever have it heard of them. So what does it practically help all the rest?
It helps you because you know that God works with exact justice. That's how it helps you. Yeah, Rebecca.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I have the same question. I have the same exact question. I don't understand. I could say, well, one person who seems to me like the most righteous, was most wonderful and person in the world, and so pure. I can't imagine her doing anything that was wrong in her life. But maybe there were things. Okay, so that's one person. But the 6 million, surely, I couldn't understand that either. And I remember asking Rabbi Victor Miller, who's passed on now, and he was a very, very practical rabbi. He told the truth about what was happening, and he knew what you were thinking. And he said to me, Rivka, he said, you can't ask why. He says, because you don't know. Exactly what Rabbi Ben-Hayim is saying now. We cannot possibly know. Sometimes the most righteous people are blamed because they were present at the time that somebody was committing a sin, and they're like an accomplice, so to speak, because they didn't stop that person. And it sounds to me very unjust. It sounds to me also like I don't like that explanation.
Well, the Talmud says
no that. Way that we could possibly know until after we go up and we have our conversation with Hashem. I asked you that question also.
Yeah, but I answered that.
Not to answer it, not to question it.
I answered that before, that the Talmud says itself that when certain tragedies happen to the world, so they may have, the world may have real severe negativity, but even the righteous people have a smaller punishment. So why? Because they didn't do something to correct it.
Right.
I mean, the Talmud itself is saying there is something is attributed as a flaw there. And King Solomon says himself that there's no righteous man. Let's read it. He says, this is, take a look, Kohelet 7:20. Kohelet 7:20. What does he say? For there's no man that is righteous in the earth that does good and doesn't sin. So the rule is that you don't have these completely perfect. If you did, so King David's rule would apply, what he communicated prophetically. That's what he's saying. But evidently, if something negative happened, there's going to be considerations, and there may be, you know, there's a lot more that we haven't learned yet. What are the considerations? I mean, that's, again, King Solomon here says these next 16 or 10 more verses, because we went through about four of them already. So about 12 more. So much for my addition skills. There's about 12 more verses that he goes into this topic. So let's explore it, but let's again keep in mind that we don't know 90%, if not more. That's generous. 90% of what a person's done or thought or acted in their life or said or spoken or how they responded. Again, there's another rule that God judges the righteous like a hair's breadth. People that are much less knowledgeable, and so on. So God is more forgiving. He works within the perfection of the person. But a person is extremely intelligent and has control and has abilities and he's very sharp. So then God will judge him much more carefully. He'll scrutinize him more. Why? For the purpose of benefiting him. Here's this one area over here where you're so knowledgeable and yet you were very loose with your lips about something. A typical person who is constantly talking that way and is not on guard, so God will not hold him to the same measure. But a person who has that training and so on, and much more should be expected of him if he slips up, Moses hitting the rock. So he vented a little bit. He was told to speak to the rock, but he hit the rock. Because of that, he could not lead the Jews into the land. A certain emotion got expressed, a certain frustration. Right? He says, listen now, you rebels. But God told him to talk to the rock. And he failed to do that because that would have been such an impression to the Jews that if he spoke to the rock and the rock brought forth the water, but no, he hit it. He had to hit it a second time. So you see how that's the examples there. But there's more rules than, that'll come up as we discuss. And there's a lot that goes into the mix. And again, the question again is coming. Even King Solomon's voicing the question. We want to see something which meets up with our understanding. I assess these people as all righteous, so why is it so many of them are just not, they're getting such tragic things are happening at that time? I'm not saying we're going to be able to answer it. I think that we can't. But what we can do is understand what God did tell us in the prophets. That we could know. So that should not be something which is, like my mom says, that's one of the three things that we accept as truth. What we experience is number one. What our mind tells us is true, that's number two. And number three, what is communicated from Sinai down through the rabbis to us. So if God is communicating this through the prophets, these have to be absolute truths. What has to be flexible is then our understanding of the experiences and how we match them up with it. And if we have to say, we don't know, we don't understand, then we say that. But we keep on exploring. There's very little that we're not allowed to subject to analysis. Most of that we experience, that we see, that we consider in life, that is something which is, God says, analyze, look into it.
Rabbi, yes, I have a question relating to the prophets. I don't have the source in front of me, but we want... I'm sorry, let me back up and figure out how to ask this right. Because God's justice is perfect, what do we do with verses where God indicates that Israel was punished double for... double what he intended for them, and the nations, they gave them more than they deserved?
I'll have to look at that. I don't have an answer to that offhand, but if you can give me the source and email it to me, I'd be glad to pick that up.
It might be a couple weeks for my books to catch up to me, but...
Well, you see it. If you have internet, if you have internet capability, I'm sure you can locate it somewhere online. So see if you can locate it, on the internet.
Yeah.
You see, again, keep in mind. Yeah, somebody has a question?
Well, I was just going to say, from the classes that I've had with Rabbi Mann, when people talk about the Holocaust, the Jewish people in the Torah, when God said, if you observe my commandments, you will experience the good, and laid out all those things, and if you don't follow my commandments, then you'll get all of these things. And we haven't had any extended period of time in history where the Jewish people as a nation have followed God's commandments. And so when you look at the Holocaust, it's like, for the Jewish people, they're supposed to be the light to the nations, and they're not doing that. And so it's pretty obvious that the consequences that were laid out, this is what happens.
Right, but Doug's question was, what about all the specifics? I understand a number of people, but for 6 million, that's the weight of the question. And there could be considerations about how God meets it out for the nation as a whole, but again, King David is saying that if you had somebody who's if it's a real tzaddik, a real pure person, so then it would not be just. I mean, don't we agree that it would not be just? That's the whole strength of Doug's question. It's not just for somebody who's not deserving to get something negative. And I agree with him 100%. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. I think that is the principle. It's just that we, I was just reading before. I don't know if you came in, because Jim had the question initially. On page 287 in the Guides for the Perplexed. Were you here when I read that? Cal?
I missed the point you were making when Jim asked the question.
Yeah, the question was that Jim had was initially was Sforno's explanation as to why the righteous seem to have it tough. That was 8:14, and why the wicked seem to have it great. So he just wanted a clarification on the Sforno. So I explained the Sforno was saying. He did not want to say it's a completely righteous person that was getting negative. He said it's a righteous person who's foolish. He's not an intellect, but he's pious. Whatever he knows, he acts on. The only thing is that he's a feeble-minded person, so there's only so much intelligence that he has. Therefore, he makes foolish decisions. He hasn't really grown intellectually yet. You can have people like that. Many people like that. They have great intent, but their intent greatly surpasses their knowledge. So their knowledge is not up to snuff. So when they make decisions, the rest of the world sees them. They are making foolish decisions, whatever it is, in business or in whatever it is that they're discussing or sciences. So they get a bad reputation. So Sforno says that's the negative thing that happens to the righteous. When you have righteous people that are really not that sharp, certain times it's going to happen that a righteous person will have a negative reputation. And just the opposite, Sforno says, is that you'll have wicked people that are very sharp intelligently. But since their inner motivation is for self-gain, so they're just going to use their intelligence to get a good impression. You know, they want to gain a good reputation for their own self-gain. The more impressive they could be, the greater position, the greater money they can attain in life. So Sforno says that's what it means that you'll see a wicked person that has it good. So that was, you know, Sforno's unique explanation. But then we got into the... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, a follow-up that I would make to Sforno is people are born with certain capabilities. Some people are born with the ability to design plans.
You're fading in and out. Can you start again?
Some people are born with the ability to be an Einstein, and some people are not. If a person does, you know, the very best with the capability that he has, it sounds like Sforno's saying, yeah, but he still may make mistakes, you know, more than the person that was born with the ability to be an Einstein, so he may still suffer more due to things outside of his control.
Yeah, that's true. He will. Those are just the facts of how the world operates. And we're not saying that this is the majority case. We're just saying there is this type of a situation where the righteous have negativity and the wicked have it great. How often does this happen? He doesn't say that. He just says this is an occurrence on earth, and that's the question. But I would say for the most part, that's not the case. For the most part, a person has a certain amount of intelligence. And if he is righteous and he is following the Torah system, he does get to a point where he can, you know, insulate himself from most harm. So I wouldn't say that this is something that, it's definitely reality, because it's true. A person makes a foolish decision, he has free will, it could come back and bite him. His reputation could suffer because of it.
Yeah, I guess I'm raising a question about justice on that. Yeah. So if you've got two people side by side, one who was born with greater capabilities than the other, and they both apply themselves to the best of their capabilities, but the first guy gets whacked, didn't have the born capability of the second guy, that adjustable.
Right. But yeah, you should know that even Einstein made a big mistake once. And that's something which, you know, I think he's definitely going to have repercussions because of that. So even a person who's got the great intelligence doesn't, you know, he doesn't escape from that either.
Rabbi?
Yeah, hold on 1 second, okay?
Okay.
Hold on. Okay, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, I just wanted to just comment again on what Rabbi Miller had said, let him rest in peace, that, and by also giving an example to Doug, because this will bother me, I think, until I really have an opportunity after 120 years to ask the question directly to Hashem, because I can't imagine 6 million people dying without there being a reason. But I had a job when I got out of high school, and the gentleman who was the owner was a very sweet, very good-natured person. He used to tell me when it was time for me to go home, instead of saying to stay later, he would tell me to go home. And he referred to himself as being the whipping boy. He was the eldest of 9 children. And I did not know at that time what the whipping boy was. And because he was the eldest and he was so good, his father used to smack him because the younger ones were out of line. And it was up to him. He got the punishment because the younger ones went out of line. It was up to him as the eldest, as the guru, and he knows better, to put them in line and not permit them to do these things. And I think in a lot of cases when we look at things, we don't understand why somebody so good would get punished. And again, Rabbi Miller had said very clearly, a lot of the times the good ones are the whipping boys. They're the ones who get punished because they should have done something to stop people from assimilating at the time and doing whatever they were doing, because a lot of people during that time were going away from Torah observance. Jewish people, righteous people, people who had money and wealth and all kinds of possessions, and they should have been so grateful that they had this, but they didn't look at it the right way. And so it was that they were meant to learn a lesson. Now, I don't like that explanation either, but these are some of the things that the great rabbis will explain to us, because we don't know really what the explanation is, and we're all sort of fishing for something to make sense. But I can understand the theory of the whipping boy.
Well, you're saying that you don't agree with it.
I don't, but I do. I do agree with it.
You can't say you don't, you do. Either you do or you don't.
Yeah, I do agree with it.
Okay.
I don't like it, but I do agree with it. And
but again, that's we have to study not people that you experience in life. We have to study, if we want to know God's principles, and his we have to study the words of the prophets. So
right.
I wouldn't take instances like that as a way to explain, because that's not the right approach. To look at what people do is not how you judge God's system. So that,
okay.
I think we just have to throw that, you know, case to the wind, because that's not an example of what God shows us. So if we really understand justice, we have to look at the prophets and look at God's acts itself. That's it. There's only 2 things that we can look at to come to some accurate assessment.
But the prophets did warn us. They told us, if we don't do this, we'll get that.
I'm not talking about what they warn and this theory, but in terms of the actual rule, or the actual, for example, God's cases of where he did punish, where he didn't punish, where he saved. We can examine that, and then we could examine the principles. So that's what we have to look at. And then, of course, the cases will come up that produce the questions that were happening. But that should not tell us that the rules are wrong. There has to be an approach that we're sticking to here. All right?
Okay. Thank you.
Doug, ahead.
So I'd like to go back and touch on a point you made at the early part of class for Maimonides there in Freelanders.
Yeah, I still have it open.
You said that he said that there are random events and then there's God's intervention.
Yes.
And I've heard that a number of times before, and it seems to suggest that God is separate from the creation that he made. And yet, I would submit that there actually is no such thing as a random event. My role of die, not random, it's just that I can't calculate all the physical vector forces and the air pressure and the density of the table the die falls on and so forth. So it appears to me to be random. But everything has, you know, a cause and effect if we had all the information. Now, if we take that position, then that would suggest that he's saying, well, well, God doesn't know which leaf's going to fall from the tree. It's like, how could he not if he created all the laws of physics and he's all-knowing and set everything in motion? How could he not possibly know that?
We didn't say he doesn't know it. He says, let me just read it to you. For I do not believe that it is through the interference of divine providence that a certain leaf drops from a tree. Meaning, it's not through God's providence, but he certainly knows it.
So what then is the difference between, I mean, if God created all these things and the world, and they all roll along and the systems happen, are we defining providence as some interference with what would have otherwise happened in that?
Yes, and he says that that's limited to beings that have intelligence. His rule, and I read later on, this is 287, divine providence is connected with divine intellectual influence. And the same beings which are benefited by the latter, meaning only human beings have intellectual influence, so only human beings, the same beings that are affected by intelligence as to become intellectual and to comprehend things comprehensible to rational beings, those beings are also under the control of divine providence, which examines all their deeds in order to reward or punish them. And he says later on, so God will, maybe when a ship sinks or a roof falls on certain people, and maybe by nature, or that God can control too, if it's going to be for punishment. And he says it may be by chance that the ship goes down. But it is not due to chance, according to our view, that in the one instance, the men went into the ship, or remained in the house, and yes, excuse me, or remained in the house. In the other instance, it is due to the will of God and is in accordance with the justice of his judgments, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. So that means that God, his providence relates to intellectual beings, meaning man, not to a leaf falling from a tree or a certain fish catching a worm. That's not where providence comes in. That's up to chance. And it's true, if you were able to calculate all the vector causes and so on to see which fish was closest to the worm, which fish's eye saw the worm, how far away, how hungry he was, you're right. Then you'd see exact, you'd be able to calculate precisely, because that is all working by precise laws. If you knew all those laws, of course you'd be God at that point. But since we can't know all those considerations, we can't know. So he's talking in human terms over here, that it's meaning God's not willing it, that this fish, but if you look at all the causes that went into motion to create fish and water and so on, so based on how God created the world at the outset, 3,000 years later, today, 5,771 years after Adam was on Earth, billions of years after he started creating the universe, if we saw all the factors, then we'd know this fish had to get that worm today. But that would not be true in terms of man. Man has the ability to you know make decisions. But the thing I want to stress is that God knows all right? Everything that he does, meaning when certain negative things or positive things happen to people, he's saying it is in accordance with the justice of his judgments. But you stop reading there at that chapter, you may come away and say, well, that means every single person, every place, something negative happens is because of God, and something positive happens because of God, right? Isn't that what you would say if you just stopped reading right there?
I'm gonna postulate that, because if God created all those things to happen with regard to the physical world, so how do I know if, the classic case of, it's Onyx walking through the forest, and at the other end, here comes a lion, and so God's providence might be that he causes a deer to jump out and distract the lion so that God gets to go all the way through. Okay. Well, suppose I'm standing, 500 yards away and I happen to see the lion and that causes me to say, I think I'll take another path. Well, was that God's personal supervision or was that laws of chance? Because he knew where the lion was going to be. In other words, given that he created all the physical systems and everything,
right?
Why couldn't I take the position that says that everything that happens to me from the physical world, I'm taking man's intervention and free will out of the equation for a second. Let's talk about the laws of nature. How do I know that everything that happens to me isn't in some way something given to me or sent to me by God, as opposed to some random roll of the dice that he didn't know.
Because he says in the next chapter, there's a lot to learn in this area. Well, I'm just going to give you an example. He quotes, this is page 289 in the guide, "The relation of divine providence is therefore not the same to all men. The greater the human perfection a person has attained, the greater the benefit he derives from divine providence. This benefit is very great in the case of prophets, and varies according to the degree of their prophetic faculty, as it varies in the case of pious and good men according to their piety and uprightness. For it is the intensity of the divine intellectual influence, meaning providence, that has inspired the prophets, guided the good of their in their actions, and perfected the wisdom in the pious. In the same proportion as ignorant and disobedient persons are deficient in that divine influence. Their condition is inferior, and their rank is equal to that of irrational beings. And they are, quote, in Psalms, like unto the beasts," meaning without any providence. "For this reason, it was not only considered a light thing to slay certain people, but it was even directly commanded for the benefit of mankind. For example, Amalek, I think we talked about last week. This belief that God provides for every individual human being in accordance with his merits is one of the fundamental principles on which the law is founded." And he goes on and explains through verses in the Torah how God related to Moses on the highest level and to other prophets on lower levels based on their level. And certain people, they're completely without. He says, for example, when we see that some men escape plagues and mishaps, while others perish by them, we must not attribute this to a difference in the properties of their bodies. It's not that one guy was stronger or weaker, or in the physical constitution. Quote, "For by strength shall no man prevail," end quote. But it must be attributed to the different degrees of perfection, some approaching God, while others move away from him. Those who approach him are best protected. And he will keep the feet. He will keep the feet of his righteous, but those who keep far away from him are left exposed to what may befall them. There is nothing that can protect them from what might happen. They are like those who walk in darkness and are certain to stumble. And he says, he gives examples after that. Go ahead.
Okay, so we talked once, a number of weeks ago, maybe months, about the reticular activating system of a person. A person starts to get interested in Porsches, wants to buy one, gets a poster at home and pins it up, and their mind's thinking about Porsches, and suddenly they start seeing Porsches all over on the road. Now, the Porsches were already there before. It's just that they're starting to notice them because their mind's focused on it. What I'm suggesting is a similar possibility, that God's intervention or providence or whatever in a person's life, because of the physical world, is there all the time, but a person at a low knowledge level doesn't even see that. But the higher your knowledge level, the more you become aware of the stuff that's around you all the time. And at a very high level, you know, you're seeing that to a very great degree. As opposed to, I guess, the idea of we sort of have this wind-up world that's running on its own thing, and then God as a separate entity comes in and tweaks it occasionally for the righteous person.
So what are you saying, that in the case of the Porsche, that God is constantly working in everybody's life? That's against what Maimonides just said.
I'm willing to take on Maimonides if I don't understand it.
Yeah, I didn't mean it that way. I just meant that he's giving quotes. He's showing sources. That, you know, this is what he's quoting from the Torah. I don't see anything which demands to say that point that you're making. It's a theory, but what is it based on? Maimonides is at least quoting verses to show that the level of providence depends on the perfection of the person. But you were making an outright statement that it's there all the time. It's just that certain people see it because they're smarter, and certain people don't. So what you're basically saying is everybody's got the same level of God's involvement. It's just some people see it, some people don't. So they're all benefiting, whether they're the lowest of the low or the greatest people, if I'm understanding you right. But that's not Maimonides' position. His his position is, and again, Bass will have to go through it. We'll take this up, or maybe we should, because these chapters are very, you know, right to the to the tone of what his son King Salman is speaking about now in Kehelis. And you know, we'd have to tread lightly, but you see, he gives one chapter about how certain things are natural, certain things are just chance, and certain things by man are providential. But then, the following chapter, he explains that there's degrees. Some people could have it functioning a lot, this providence, and some people could be like animals, meaning where they're completely left up to chance, that they are left exposed to what may befall them. Maimonides says it's page 290.
So, I guess what I'm troubled by, maybe I'm troubled by a lot of things, this concept of chance, because it suggests that I've made a little wind up world, and now it's running like a little Energizer bunny, and that it's sort of like an arbitrary pinball machine. If you happen to step in this spot right here, you're going to get banged. If the spot something or whatever, but that at certain times God will step in and tweak the system to protect this guy from this or that. And what I'm trying to wrap my arms around or my head around is the idea, well, if God created everything and knows all the causes, the effects, and the things that will happen, like including, you know, that this leaf is going to fall off this tree at this time, then he also knows, then it would seem like that there's no chance involved.
But why is knowledge demand cause, according to you? Just because God knows something doesn't mean that I don't have free will.
Well, I'm not taking away free will. I mean, I'm talking about the world of the laws of nature, and I realize that, you know...
But you just said that he says he knows it all. So you just said, if he knows it all, so where's the element of chance? So... free will is one case where he knows it all and there's no chance. So why can't natural law also? He knows it all, but there's no real, there's nothing really directing this leaf at this moment.
Because apart from, I'm open to be told that this presumption is incorrect, but apart from the free will of man, I will hold that there is no randomness otherwise.
Okay, so let's clarify it. I think we may agree here. I think the term randomness is not to be synonymously used with will. Let's see if we can separate the two. I think what you're saying is that since there is something that happens, I mean, that something, since everything except for free will is all, you know, it's a domino effect from when God first created the universe. So if that's true, so isn't that really that God is causing every single angle on the branches of every single tree and the length of every single branch in every tree, isn't that really caused by God? Yes, it is caused. What we're saying is, that there a will that this branch should be a centimeter longer than another branch? No. We're not saying it is will. That's what the Maimonides is saying. It's not the will that this fish should catch that worm and not the other worm.
What's the difference between will? Because if he set a system up that's a domino system that results in this fish catching that worm,
right,
and that had to have been his intent.
Because what would be the justice, or that this worm should die and not the other worm, or that this fish should eat that worm and not eat the other one? There has to be a sensible explanation if you can say it's God's will that he desires this specific action. Or you can say, no, his desire is that there should be the species of fish, that there should be certain numbers of them, certain locations in the world. This is going to help the overall, I forget the word or how it works, that you have the food chain, and then how the atmosphere, and so on and so forth. It affects the soil. Whatever the existence of this fish is going to do is necessary for the world, necessary for man, but which individual ones eat which individual worms, that is not something which affects. So that is not something which his will extends to. It's true, it's all a result of him putting species on Earth. But I can see clearly a difference between his will, or is it just a result of what he did in creation?
Well,
not that he wills these specific actions, that these specific leaves must fall at a certain angle. I mean, it just gets to the point where your mind just can't appreciate that there's any difference, that there's any effect whatsoever. Who cares if this leaf falls off the tree this second or a second later? Is there really no measurable benefit or loss? So that's why my mind is just saying, I believe, that it's not, that it's not as the, and he says, for I do not believe. It's his opinion. I think it's easy. Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
I can understand that's his opinion.
Right.
Okay? He could say, so what difference does it make whether this leaf falls or not? You happen to live near a river, okay, and the river is cresting near flood stage, you know, and it's just a natural phenomenon. We could say, well, what difference does it make whether it rises another 3 inches or not? Well, if you're the guy living next door to the river, it makes a big difference.
Right, but you'd be hard-pressed to show out of all the billions of leaves that fall in every state, and trillions, and whatever the bigger number is after that, that fall yearly on the earth, that what's the difference, what angle they fall at?
But if you're talking about infinite intelligence, I don't find that hard to accept at all. I mean, it almost sounds like, I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding Maimonides, but he's sort of limiting a little bit, and I can't imagine he would, you know, limiting the ability of God to know every molecule on the planet and exactly what it's doing.
No. I think you're making the same mistake again we said before. He's not limiting God's knowledge. God does know all these things, but his knowledge does not translate to cause. It's not that he's willing this specific leaf to go on this angle at this point. He knows it's happening.
But if we take a specific leaf and we back up the cause and effect chain, okay, why did that leaf fall? Well, because this particular part got weak. Why did that particular part got weak? Because the weather came along and dried it out. Why did the weather come along and dry it out and go backwards and backwards and backwards? Because if we say that, well, there is no cause of that leaf falling.
No, Will. There is a cause. I agree with you. Because God created the world a certain way, that leaf had to fall at this precise moment at that angle. I'm not doubting that.
But you're making a distinction between the fact that God caused a chain of events which resulted in all these things and his will that all those things happened.
Yes. Meaning, he caused the creation, but it doesn't matter that what angle the leaves fall at. What matters is that there is this thing of leaves falling in the fall. Yes, because he created it, there are certain things that are going to happen. I remember once asking Rabbi Chait, does a snowflake have to have six, there goes my addition skills again, have six corners, or six angles, whatever you want to call them, by design, or could it be that is just a result from the fact that there has to be crystalline structures when it combines with moisture and temperature changes? So he said, yeah, it could be the latter. It could be that is just because of certain other things that are primary. You need water. That for sure is God's will. It says he created the water. So since he created water and temperature, so by definition, there are other things that are going to now happen that must occur because of that. But that's not, the will is for the water and for the temperature change, not that every flake should have six corners. That is just a result in terms of how water is designed and how temperature works. You see the difference or no? I know it's a tough issue, because if it's all traced back, and God's the only one involved, so it's like he caused it, he willed it. What's the difference? But just the way I understand will is that this event must take place. Cause just means that it is a result from your initial creation. That, we agree.
And I think that, I guess where I'm coming from is, given the infinite nature of God's wisdom and knowledge, I don't see a difference. For example, if it's his will that deer jump out in front of that lion to save that buck, that he knew knew that from the very beginning, and that that was part of that original kickoff of the entire universe. Because I guess I don't see any difference between the leaf falling and him willing this must happen versus, well, it could happen or might not happen, and I don't really care, because that kind of implies that he lost control at some point.
No, he doesn't lose control. It's just that's not his will. That is not something which is important in the scheme of things. Which lion eats which zebra is not important. The fact that lions should exist and zebras should exist, that's important.
Yeah, maybe we could go on forever. That strikes me as man's viewpoint of it. But, I mean, I could start to take different cases like, well, if they're all out in the wild, then it didn't matter. But, well, now in this case, if you've gotten this zebra, then that would have meant this other zebra wouldn't have been around for this traveler to be able to have taken for food when he was starving, or, you know.
You might be able to prove a case like that, but that's a one isolated instance.
Yeah, but it sounds like this is coming down to a discrete difference between either A, God cares, or B, God doesn't care.
Yeah, that's what Maimonides is saying. He doesn't care about which leaf is falling. That's not where his will extends to.
And he seems like to me putting a limit on God's will, and I can see that it could be, when we talk about caring or not caring, or the effect on man or no effect on man, I could see a continuum easier than I could see a discrete on or off.
Yeah, but keep in mind, he's not limiting God's extension of his power to the creation, because you see he shut the lion's mouth by Daniel when he went into the lion's den. It's just that those are specific cases. He has complete control. When he wants to make a certain event happen, he can control whatever he wants. We're not taking that away from him. We're not taking away knowledge. Maybe take a look at that chapter. Read through it. I'd like to do that as well, tell you the truth. It's a chapter 17. Looks like it's book 2. Unless it's book 3. Let's see. It's on Providence. And do you have the same edition that Friedlander?
Yeah, the red paperback?
Yeah, that's it. Okay, so it's 282 it starts.
282 it starts?
Yeah, on 282. He gives five different theories of providence. The fifth one being the rabbis, but then he deviates, Maimonides deviates, and then gives his own opinion. So don't assume he is agreeing with the rabbis. Okay, then he gives his opinion. In my opinion, he first starts on 286, the last paragraph, so keep that in mind. And then you have to read 289 too. Which is the next chapter, which is 18. So 17 and 18. And you'll read 19. He talks about the God is perfect in every respect. And the earlier chapter, that the God is not ignorant of anything. I think that may be, where did he say that? He says, that's 19, chapter 19. He's not deficient in anything. That means he's not deficient of knowledge. There's a big context that has to be put into it, so look through it. And if anybody else has the book, they should do it. But it's also actually on, I posted the whole book on the Masora site, so I did this where people can do a search by keyword and find things very quickly in the guide. So if you go to masora.org/guide.html, you'll find the entire book there. Some people had scanned it a while back, and they put it into a online forum, so I took a copy of it and put it onto the site so we could have it for reference. Okay. Yep, not an easy subject matter. All right, so we're on for next week?
I think so.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so let's look it all over. Look over these chapters, everybody. And And keep in mind also what we're doing with Kahelis. And we'll pick up next week same time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
Okay, have a good week, everybody.
Yeah, have a good week, everybody. Bye.
Be well.
Be well.
South Carolina.